I sat a long time on the old wooden church pew beneath the tree because I needed to assess what my return to Swamp Creek might mean. My sudden reappearance would surely cause some kind of disturbance, although such was not my intention. I had hoped a 10-year hiatus would provide my family and me with sufficient distance for old wounds to heal. Deep within, I knew better. Time doesn't heal old wounds. It just makes them bearable.
Today on Arts and Letters, we'll be talking with novelist Daniel Omotosho Black from Blackwell, Arkansas, whose four published novels focus on home, history, and identity. Black's first novel, They Tell Me of a Home, published in 2005, embraces a kind of personal mythology.
10 years, and there I was again. I had received a PhD in Black Studies a month earlier and felt compelled to return to the place of my origin. Exactly why, I didn't know, but for some reason, I felt the need to go home.
So turn up the volume and head to your front porches as Arkansas Tales come of age when we return to Arts and Letters with novelist Daniel Omotosho Black. Up next. For the University of Arkansas at Little Rock, I'm J. Bradley Minnick, and welcome to Arts and Letters, a program providing opportunities for the celebration of the arts and humanities.
Oh, they tell me of a home far beyond the skies. And they tell me of a home far away. Oh, they tell me of a home where no storm clouds rise. Oh, they tell me of an unclouded day.
Today we'll be talking with award-winning Arkansas novelist Daniel Black. His best-selling novels, They Tell Me of a Home, The Sacred Place, Perfect Peace, 12 Gates to the City, and the soon-to-be-released The Coming, have all been published by St. Martin's Press. In much of Black's fiction, there is a deep felt sense of Arkansas.
Oh, they tell me of an unclouded day.
In They Tell Me of a Home, protagonist T.L., replete with his newly minted PhD and his suitcase filled with his pile of books, takes a bus back to fictional Swamp Creek, Arkansas, a place he vowed never to return after high school. Once off the bus, he encounters the Arkansas heat and finds his way to the shade of the meeting tree, which stood broader like a great elder watching over a flock of children.
Every Friday night, people came and listened to John Lee tell lies or watch Miss Liza May strip naked as the liquor took effect. As children, my friends and I caught lightning bugs in the field next to the tree as the grown folks told their stories. Sometimes we'd listen too, but always from a distance. Children didn't sit with elders back in those days.
Oh, the land of cloudless days. Oh, the land of an uncloudy sky.
He meets Old Man Blue.
A little pickup truck pulled off the highway onto the bare dirt spot in front of the tree, and out stepped Old Man Blue. "Hey there, young fella," he said, obviously not recognizing me beneath the brim of my hat. "You from round these here parts?"
Oh, they tell me of a home where no storm clouds rise.
He encounters ghosts of a past childhood he thought long forgotten.
The house resembled a person in mourning over the loss of a child. The crumbling porch, barely hanging wooden screen door, and broken windows all reminded me that I hadn't been home in a very long time.
Daniel Black, scholar, professor, cultural critic, novelist, welcome home.
Thanks, Brad. Really happy to be here.
So, Daniel, tell us about this narrative.
This narrative is really about a young man who has a very difficult emotional time in this very rural place in Arkansas. And he vows that he's going to leave home. He has not gained enough maturity to really learn to value the place for what it is. And so he believes that there is some magical place out in the world that will embrace him and love him and celebrate him. And so this novel is about him leaving in search of that place.
When he finally finds his way home, T.L. encounters his brother, Willie James, sitting on a tractor, who has stayed behind in Arkansas to tend the farm. Let's listen.
Where you been all this time?
I went to college, remember?
Oh, yeah. You left here right after you finished high school. I didn't know college took people 10 years to finish.
10 years later, he has found, through some level of maturity, that place does not exist, that the real place which carries his spirit is, in fact, his home, Swamp Creek, Arkansas.
It's a long story, man. I'm sorry. I had to get away.
Okay, fine. But why didn't you call or at least write? You always like to write.
And so this novel is a novel of redemption. It's a novel of returning. It's a novel of a young man coming back to find his place among a people.
Let's not start this. It's too hot out here to argue.
We ain't starting nothing. You started this 10 years ago.
It's also an encounter between brothers who choose different paths in life.
Yes, yes, yes. And in many ways, those paths, they intersect, but it didn't seem as if they would. Both have successes and they have regrets, and both need others at critical points in their junctures. But their emotional need for each other, quite frankly, is far greater than the need of their life choices.
In They Tell Me of a Home, the main character, T.L., returns home and confronts his father and his brother, both of whom know his core, but don't really understand him. And then he has to deal with his mother.
Why aren't you glad to see me, Mama?
I am glad to see you.
You could have fooled me.
Well, you fooled me 10 years ago.
Mama, you know why I left. Don't act like you don't.
Yeah, I know why you left, but I don't know why you stayed gone so long.
What would I have to come back to? What was here for me?
Your sister. I couldn't say anything to make her understand.
Where's that girl anyway? I know she's grown.
She's out back. She's been waiting on you a long time.
Mama was not going to let up, so I decided to go see sister. When I exited the back door, I immediately saw her tombstone.
Cynthia Jane Tyson, 1970 to 1987. Loving sister and daughter.
I fell to the ground in shock and horror, screaming at the top of my lungs, "Sister, sister, no!" I rolled on the ground with snot pouring out of my nose and tears screaming from my eyes, "Oh God, sister, no! Please, sister, no! Oh God, no! Not you, sister! Please, sister, not you!"
Some glad morning when this life is o'er, I'll fly away to a place on God's celestial shore. I'll fly away. I'll fly away, oh glory. I'll fly away in the morning when I die. Hallelujah, by and by. I'll fly away.
You graduated from Tiny Morrilton High School?
I did.
At 20, you earned the prestigious Oxford Modern British Studies Fellowship, which sent you to Oxford University. Upon graduation, you were awarded a full scholarship to Temple University, where you worked on They Tell Me of a Home. How are you like and unlike your character of T.L.?
Well, I guess I'm like T.L. in that I love to read and write. I left Arkansas to attend college. All of that is true. But I'm unlike T.L. in that I visited quite regularly. I certainly didn't take a 10-year hiatus and disappear. I'm like T.L. in that I grew up with a younger sister whom I adore, but my sister's not dead and buried in the backyard, so none of that part is true. I'm like T.L. in that I've grown to question traditional concepts of God and religion, which the Black church taught me, but I'm unlike T.L. in that I have not abandoned the church. I'm very much committed to the Black church and its theological evolution.
I'll fly away, oh glory, I'll fly away in the morning when I die, hallelujah, by and by, I'll fly away, I'll
Although growing up protagonist T.L. does not get the support from his father, he does from a teacher named Miss Swinton.
Miss Swinton went into her desk and pulled out a brand new book. I began to sweat. I know how much you like to read, and I see how hard you work. Take this book, read it, and keep it for yourself. Don't tell anyone you have it. It's our secret. In fact, why don't we start reading it together if you have time?
As a boy, how are you supported by your teachers, especially in your quest to write?
You know, I'm one who's had probably the best teachers a small-town country boy could have imagined. I had one teacher in particular, Miss Ann Crowfoot Queen, who took me under her wings and groomed me to be a scholar, to be an academic. She was tough in the classroom, but she made it absolutely clear that she thought I had this intellectual acumen. And the fact that she believed in me, she gave me books. I went to her house. In fact, I remember one time I wrote a term paper and I was too excited about her grading it to sleep. And I called her on the weekend and asked her if I could come to her house and if she had finished it. And she said, "Daniel, come on." And I literally went to her home and she gave me the term paper. And the grade wasn't as high as I had hoped. And I was literally devastated. And in some ways I was most devastated because I just wanted to make her proud.
T.L. becomes enamored by one particular poem by Paul Laurence Dunbar. Would you read it to us?
The Lesson by Paul Laurence Dunbar. My cot was down by a cypress grove, and I sat by my window the whole night long, and heard well up from the deep dark wood a mockingbird's passionate song. And I thought of myself so sad and lone, in my life's cold winter that knew no spring, of my mind so weary and sick and wild, of my heart too sad to sing. But even as I listened to the mockingbird's song, a thought stole into my saddened heart. And I said, I can cheer some other soul by a carol's simple art. For all from the darkness of hearts and lives come songs that brim with joy and light. As out of the gloom of the cypress grove, the mockingbird sings at night. So I sang a lay for a brother's ear in a strain to soothe his bleeding heart. And he smiled at the sound of my voice and lyre, though mine was a feeble art. But at his smile, I smiled in turn, and into my soul there came a ray. In trying to soothe another's woes, my own had passed away.
What did the lesson, Paul Laurence Dunbar's The Lesson, mean to you growing up?
I think what I love most about Dunbar is that he could capture the heart in this rhythm of language. And when I would hear this rhythm of language, I would begin to like tingle physically. And I just knew that I wanted to be able to do that one day. And just to know that a black man had written these kinds of words that could move the heart in this way. He had this magical, beautiful, lyrical language, and it just really, really, really moved me. And I decided that if he had done this, that this was the kind of route, this was the kind of life I wanted to live, to put words on a sheet of paper and move hearts all over the world.
We're talking with Arkansas novelist Daniel Omotosho Black. His novels focus on home, history, identity, and personal mythology. Let's return to the mythical Swamp Creek with its sacred spaces and secrets.
Grandma and I had created a sacred space there, sharing secrets and crying tears together, and I simply didn't want anyone else in her house. The truth of my childhood confronted me, however, and I was forced to let it go.
Is Swamp Creek a sacred space?
Swamp Creek is absolutely a sacred space. And the meeting tree is a sacred space within a sacred space. And it's a sacred people who sometimes didn't even see their own beauty. But I feel like my job as a writer is to expose the beauty of people who may not have seen it themselves.
Let's talk about sacred spaces. That's the title of your second book?
Yes.
The Sacred Space?
Yes.
Could you tell us a little bit about why you're so interested in sacred spaces?
In so many instances, African Americans in America have been locked out of places. We have been locked out of schools. We've been locked out of churches. We've been locked out of politics. We've been locked out of believing that we were even human beings. And so sacred space for African American people has been hard to find. And in many instances, we've had to create it. We've literally had to make places holy in order to have a place where we felt as if our being and our identity was not being challenged. All of my help, all of my help, it comes from the Lord, comes from the Lord. And so I'm very, very, very proud of a people who didn't just accept the reality of being locked out of sacred spaces, but who took the kind of agency and said, then fine, we'll make our own.
Comes from the Lord whenever I need.
And I think that's an act of cultural agency. I think that's an act of spiritual enlightenment and spiritual power. And so I'm very much interested and very celebratory of a people who took the chance to say, I'm going to be sacred because I believe I am, whether others agree or not.
He looked beyond.
He looked beyond.
He looked beyond my faults and saw my needs.
Your third novel, Perfect Peace, describes the mysterious nature of collective personal identity. Would you set up Perfect Peace for us?
Perfect Peace is the story of Emma Jean and Gus Peace. They are a couple in the 1940s in Swamp Creek, Arkansas, and they have six boys. Emma Jean has wanted the girl from the time she was a little girl. But lo and behold, she keeps having these boys, one boy after another, after another, after another, after another, until Gus decides he doesn't want any more children. Because, of course, with their luck, it's going to be another boy. And Emma Jean gets pregnant for the seventh time. The novel opens with her giving birth.
Push! Ah! Oh, my God! I thought having a girl would be so much easier than having them big, knuckle-headed boys.
Henrietta chuckled. She had delivered almost every child in Conway County since the 1920s. And if nothing else, she had learned that a baby's gender could never be predicted.
This might be another boy, Emma. Don't get your hopes up too high. Plenty of women think they having one thing and have something else. Now breathe and push again.
Of course, she's certain this must be her girl. God would not possibly deny her, not to this extent.
Emma Jean sighed, refusing to relinquish hope that she was finally birthing the daughter she'd always wanted.
But she births another boy.
I'm gonna go on and tell the men folks.
You ain't gonna tell them nothing. Nothing but what I tell you.
Excuse me?
You gonna tell them that they got a new baby sister. That's what you gonna tell them. And she just as cute as she can be.
What? What did you say?
That's right. This is my baby girl. At least now she is.
That ain't no girl. I know you wanted one and all of it, but
And now I got one.
What?
You heard me. I said, this is my baby girl, and that's all there is to it.
So the setup of the novel is that Emma Jean decides she's going to rear her seventh son as the daughter she's always wanted.
I don't understand what you're saying, Emma Jean Peace.
Oh, sure you do. It ain't deep.
It must be deep, because I ain't getting it.
This is my daughter, and don't look at me like I'm crazy.
You is crazy. You must have been lost your mind, Emma Jean. That ain't no girl.
I know what it is, but it's going to be a girl from now on.
I saw a child one day, Brad, whose gender I could not determine. The reality troubled me. Then I began to wonder what a child's life might be like if others never knew its gender. My mind kind of began to spin out of control. I began to imagine how people would treat this individual. And so outbirthed this novel. Gus and the boys sat in the living room and waited. Knowing no other way to pass the time, Gus read passages from the Bible, the few he could read, in hopes that something from the word might still his rumbling heart. He would love the baby, he resolved, but he would never forgive Imogene. Never. And if the rains didn't come, he wouldn't forgive them either.
You set the book almost like a family Bible with a clear lineage. All of the characters, particularly the younger Peace brothers, James Earl, Authorly, Woody, King Solomon, Blind Bartimaeus, and Mister. Could you describe the origin of these names?
The importance of these names is that they carry this double meaning, which is part of the African naming tradition. That a name both tells you who you are, but it also tells you the role you're supposed to play among the people. So Blind Bartimaeus, yes, he is blind physically, but he's also the most sighted individual in the book. He knows everything before anybody knows it. She lifted Perfect from her left side. Bartimaeus extended his arms with great expectation. The weight of the child made him giggle. Gently, he moved his forefinger across her forehead, eyelids, nose, mouth, and chin.
She's beautiful. I can tell a baby sister. Wow.
That's right.
She's got my nose.
Only then did Imogene realize that Perfect, Bartimaeus, and Gus shared identical wide, flat noses. Perfect's was tiny, but its shape was unmistakable.
I guess she does.
The names are very indicative of a people who, through the power of naming, are trying to infuse children with a sense of self-worth and identity.
Wade in the water, wade in the water, children.
I come from people who were never asked, who were never given permission, who were never allowed to construct identity for themselves. I come from people who were always handed an identity, who were always told who they were, who were always told what they should call themselves even, who were even given names from people who despised them. And so this notion that one gets the right, that one gets the kind of universal invitation to construct oneself is a fascinating notion. It's an absolutely fascinating notion. And quite frankly, it's one that I think even now Black folks in America have still been a bit cautious about because it's so very new, historically speaking.
Now who's that girl all dressed in white? God's gonna trouble the water. Must be the children of the Israelites.
God's gonna trouble the water.
You better wait in the water.
There's been all this nomenclature around what should we call these people? But the question never was, what do you call yourself? And thus we will honor that.
But at the same point, Imogene names Perfect.
That's right.
And he doesn't have agency for
that's,
his...
That's right.
So what are you doing there mm-hmm. about the notion uh-huh. of naming mm-hmm. too?
And in fact, ironically, what Imogene does is exactly what has been done to her. And that's part of the point of the book. That Imogene literally takes on the mantle of oppression as she has known it. And she constructs Perfect into the being she wants, which is precisely what folks have done to her, which is precisely what people have done to her people. She tries to extract from another human being her own sense of worth. And part of the point of the book is, what price do we make people pay?
In the water, children, wade.
When we make them what we want them to be and when we give them an identity that does not belong to them.
God's gonna trouble the water. God's gonna trouble the water. God's gonna trouble the water.
So much of Perfect Peace happens around or outside or within the church.
Right.
How does the church and then religion influence the work?
Black people in America, and it's no less true for those of us in Arkansas, have a very, very rich spiritual tradition.
Amazing grace shall always be my song of praise.
And in fact, really the spirituality, the religion of the Black community has been its cornerstone, has been its stalwart kind of backbone.
For it was grace that bought my liberty.
And it is that backbone that really informs everything Black folks do.
I do not know just how he can. came to love me so.
And so African-American literature could not be African-American literature without the Black church, without the infusion of spirituality in the text.
How marvelous.
And specifically in Perfect Peace, these folks live in this rural place called Swamp Creek. And in this rural place, the seat of authority is the church. The church, the preacher decides everything, quite frankly. And because that is true, it is true also in this household. And I think even the title of this novel, Perfect Peace, is indicative of a kind of spiritual yearning with which these people are obsessed. That can be hard to find, but it's still, folks still believe in it anyway.
So Swamp Creek is in They Tell Me of a Home.
That's right.
And Swamp Creek is in Perfect Peace.
That's right.
Why Swamp Creek, this fictional place that is situated in a real place?
Sure. I am very much concerned with the creation of sense of place, yes. I think also I'm very much concerned with how places change character and change identity over time. And one of the things about rural Black folks in the South is up until maybe certainly the last 10 or 20 years, most Black folks in the South lived in the same place on the same land for 3 and 4 and 5 generations. So literally the character of a people could be known if a person knew that land. The land spoke in very metaphorical terms and could tell us the history of these people. Because most often people were very stationary, people were very sedentary, because it was the only plot of land they owned in the world. And because Black folks have never really believed that America was ours in the truest sense of the term. They have created places that they believe could be theirs if it was only a small fraction of the world. And so this sense of place is extremely, extremely important. It's where people buried, it's where people lived, it's where people died. And because the land outlives the people, there are ways in which when the land speaks, its story is more reliable.
Broadcast from the University District, this has been a special program on KUAR 89.1. Thanks for joining us. Arts and Letters and other programming that airs on this station can be found at KUAR.org. Leave us a comment there and let us know what you've thought about the program. Thank you to the Damsels in Distress and Sam Gregory, who supplied the instrumental music. Thank you to Clark Harris, Josette Barger, Ray Turner, Trevor Collins, Charity Burt, and Lonnie Brooks, who supplied their voices. Thank you to Charlotte Taylor and Daniel Black for your uplifting voices and singing. Thank you to Vesta Mullins, Ronald Hampton, Donna Collins, Terry Rolfe, Helen Wayne, and Darius Nelson of St. Mark Baptist Church Praise Team for the hymns. And thank you to Nathan Vandiver for recording them. Thank you to the extraordinary Chris Hickey for producing the show. Support for this program comes from the Arkansas Humanities Council. On behalf of the College of Arts, Letters, and Sciences, thank you to novelist and Arkansas author Daniel Omotosho Black. For Arts and Letters, I'm J. Bradley Minnick, hoping in the words of James Baldwin, love does not begin and end the way we seem to think it does. Love is a battle. Love is a war. Love is growing up.